doctrines of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ's Church.
Preston in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO. Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I am back with Professor Frank Buckley. As you probably do know, because he's been on the show now a number of times, Frank is the foundation professor at the Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. His most recent book, which I hope is turning out to be the blueprint for the Trump presidency, is The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America from Encounter in 2016. Frank, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I was great to be with you.
Now, you are also now a weekly columnist for the New York Post. And your last column was entitled, Trump is Refusing to Go Native in Washington, D.C. That seems to be a pretty good rubric under which to talk about all that's going on.
Well, there's certainly a lot of it. I mean, I was writing about the inauguration speech, which I didn't have a hand in. And, it was a remarkable exercise of Mr. President Trump saying, yep, I meant it.
Well, you know, I was sitting next to a lobbyist who seemed mysteriously to know that supposedly Trump had written this speech himself. Can you confirm that?
I can't confirm it, but it bears something of a thumbprint of Steve Bannon, but I think it really was Trump. I don't think it was Stephen Miller. I think it really was Trump.
Were you surprised a bit by the explicit religiosity of the speech?
Not really. I think there was a certain religious awakening in Trump. I mean, the guy is not... he's sort of a Frank Sinatra type, a throwback to a somewhat earlier age, a bit of a playboy until recently. But you know something, as one gets older, there's a time when one puts that aside, and I think the experience of becoming president and specifically getting support from so many religious people, Catholics, Protestant, Jews, I think that meant something very important to him.
The crowd was amazing, as you know. I mean, being there live, you feel this wave. You hear a shout go up, you know, back by the Washington Monument, and then you feel it, and it comes, washes over you at the front and up the steps. They particularly got on to Senator Chuck Schumer. I thought his remarks were completely inappropriate. What do you think?
I thought they were completely inappropriate. They were partisan. I don't know how he got that amount of speaking time. His was a partisan address, but then I suppose so was Trump's.
But it was his day. It's Trump's day, you know.
It was in fact Trump's day.
It's just bad manners. I mean, from about the first paragraph, Schumer got up there and he was shooting barbs at the new president.
Yeah, although, the new president surely didn't hang back in sending barbs right back. And indeed, it was Trump's day, and it was a day which I think made many of the people on the stage behind him somewhat uncomfortable. It was, as I said in the post, something of a bitch slap for these people. It was a repudiation of the way things had gone on for so long.
That was your last line. I like that. I was going to bring it up myself, but you beat me to it.
Well, you know, it was kind of funny. I mean, I've taken to putting my email in these things right now. And
uh-oh.
Got a lot of emails saying, I love it. I can't believe the New York Post went for it.
Well, if you are getting responses, are they? How many awful ones are you getting?
Oh, I'm not getting a whole lot. The awful ones I just burn off right away. I don't even pay any attention. You know something? No, I don't think anybody who writes should ever pay much attention to the emails. Except I always say thank you to people who are nice, and I sometimes respond to people who aren't. But I'm not going to it's not going to affect me emotionally one way or the other.
For our listeners, Frank Buckley's column, does it come out on the same day every week, Frank?
No, it doesn't. It varies.
It comes out weekly on the New York Post, and it's very informative. I have signed up myself for the New York Post daily feed, although I do see on Facebook where Frank very kindly posts it when it comes out. But it's certainly worth following, as are several other good columnists on the New York Post.
Yep.
Who would you recommend the most there?
Well, on healthcare, where I personally draw a bit of a blank, Betsy McCoy is pretty good at explaining
yes.
the unexplainable. She's quite good. There's a lady called Selena Zito, I think, who is quite good as well. She came on board the Post the same time I did, and she's a reporter out of Pittsburgh, but she was really remarkable. She's also on the John Batchelor show. And Batchelor, over the course of a summer, had these two ladies on, and one was Zito, and then there was this academic from Pittsburgh. And the academic was saying what academics do. And Zito, she used to hang around in pool halls and bars and places like that. And she came back and she said, you know, people like Trump. So she was, the very model of the seven sages in Yeats's poem. She traveled the highways and she mimicked what she heard.
Well, I think that was the key to understanding early on where that election was going. Now, the one bit of controversy I wanted you to address was the directive to the EPA about not getting on Twitter or social media. I know the historian Stephen Sharma sent out a kind of ridiculous tweet on that. What did you think of that?
Well, I didn't even know that they tweeted, but I think it's quite inappropriate for government officials to have a public voice like that.
I mean they work for somebody, right? They work for somebody.
The voice of the government is the government. There's or should not be a separate administrative state which is separate from the U.S. government. We know what the U.S. government is. These other folks seem to think that they're part of the government apparatus, and they get to tell us what's happening, and that seems to me entirely inappropriate. So that's a policy which I think should be extended throughout. You know, when somebody speaks for the State Department, it's a formal thing, and, you know, you have a regular spokesperson, or for the NSC, there's a regular spokesperson, and whatever is said is vetted. Right, like Sean Spicer
for
the White House. That's how you get news.
Well, I know one of the two people I've ever had to fire in my life, I fired for doing precisely the same thing, thinking that somehow this person that worked for me could freelance on the basis of my name and my magazine.
Yeah. By the way, before we forget about the Post, I hope you noted that Sean Spicer's first question on Monday was for a Washington Post reporter, and then it was for two reporters for Christian Broadcasting Network. And then it was, yesterday, I guess, the first question was for Life News, which is Laura Ingraham, and today it was the Washington Times. So all those guys from AP and the Washington Post and the New York Times, they're going nuts.
Well, I think it's long overdue that they be put in their place. And
yes.
You know, here they are, they just did everything they could, and it was a matter of public record that they intended to do so, to elect Hillary Clinton. Why do they expect to be getting the first or second question in a Trump press conference?
Well, they've done it to themselves. It's not the case that anyone thinks that they're a purveyor of truth. There are journals of partisan opinion that are passing themselves off as the keepers of the truth, and they're anything but that. Anybody reading the Washington Post, for example, or the New York Times, just sees that bias all over the place, and it's inconsistent with what a reporter is or should be. So they've done, they don't deserve it.
Is there any reporting anymore?
I just don't see it. There are a few people here and there who are good old-fashioned, you know, wear out the shoe leather of your shoes reporters. There are a few people, Robert Costa at the Post, Chris Saliza at the Post, but mostly not.
And a couple at the New York Times.
Mostly they're not even trying. They're not even trying. You know, they basically, they all think they can write up editorials.
Yeah, every now and then I'll see this really outstanding research reported piece in the Times or the Post, and I go, wow, you know, these people still exist. They're still out there.
Yeah, there are niche people. There are people who write about, in the Post, for example, about campaign finance reform. The name Mattia Gold comes to mind. And they just do what reporters should do. But right. Apart from that, no. I mean,
I remember
stories aren't.
I used to regularly have breakfast with Robert Novak at the Army Navy Club, and he would constantly tell me about how, since he came to D.C., I think it had been 40 years ago, he's gradually watched all the major papers become advocates, and all the major columnists and reporters become advocates. And he wasn't worried about naming names. He did, and I won't rename them here. I think it's pretty obvious. And I noticed yesterday, one of the guys he did name was E.J. Dionne, who yesterday published co-editing the speeches of Barack Obama.
Oh, it's the hagiography is absolutely embarrassing. I mean, we didn't have to wait till 2016 to figure this out, or 2015. We saw it all in 2008 and the adulation of Obama. I mean, at that point, the press had completely lost it.
Well, I don't think anybody will ever think that Donald Trump deserves a hagiography.
No, I don't think so either.
But.
And, you know, he will require people who will point out, now you're going a little bit too far here, Donald. But in general, you know, conservatives should be more than satisfied with where things are going. I mean, we'll have a Supreme Court choice next week, next Thursday, I guess. And the betting is it'll be someone in the mold of Nino Scalia. And that's pretty good. And it's likely he'll have another choice, and you know, before the time is up, and it'll probably be another such person.
Well, we've already had the Mexico City policy reaffirmed. By the way, when I first started talking to the Trump campaign about that in March, they didn't know what it was.
Yeah, right.
And I actually sent a message to somebody very close to the campaign on the pro-life side, and I said, I just said that, and she wrote me back, well, a lot of them still don't know what it is. Anyway, it looks like we're going to have a bill defunding Planned Parenthood in the United States go to the president's desk, and we've had action today on national security. What do you think of those actions? Tell our listeners what he did today.
Well, you may be ahead of me. I know that Sebastian Gorka is going to the NSC. What are you referring to?
Well, today he gave a speech, Donald Trump, at the National Department of Homeland Security, and he announced that I think seven countries there would be a moratorium on visas, including Syria.
Yes, I saw that. I saw the executive order.
And he's also. Says that we're going to start building the wall using monies already in hand at the Department of Homeland Security. And I don't know if the room was papered, as we say, but the audience at Homeland Security sure was enthusiastic.
Okay, fantastic. I saw the executive order. I didn't see the video of the presentation. You know, it's kind of sad. My feelings about refugees are kind of mixed. This is naturally a generous country. And the reason why it can't be generous is simply because one can't trust elected officials or appointed officials. Now, it would be nice if we recognize that America has, to some extent, contributed to the problems in Iraq and the Middle East. And that, therefore, there is a special responsibility to try to cure the problem, and part of that includes taking in refugees. But up to now, all the refugees we've taken have been Islamic. In short, we'd like to do something, but we can't trust our officials to bring in the kind of people who really need help. Now, you know, Islamic people are not the people who are threatened. The Christians are the people who are being threatened. But I guess it's a bridge too far to say we're going to distinguish between Christians and non-Christians. I mean, that is exactly what we should be doing. But again, I guess there's a trust issue.
I don't know if you saw the feed, but he had about a half dozen parents of children who had been killed by illegal immigrants, named them by name, and had them stand up.
Yep, I saw that. And this is, you know, this is the nature of the problem, right? It's you can't easily fine-tune this down to the level of getting exactly the right kind of people. And when that happens, maybe the best you can do is just have a blanket policy, which applies generally to people coming in from certain countries. Maybe at a later stage, we'll be able to we'll trust our officials enough to fine-tune it to bring in the right kind of refugees. Clearly, the people who are threatened were the Christians. You know, not just the Christians, but other religious minority groups as well. And these are the people that ISIS beheads. So if ever there's a claim for refugee status, it's those people, and we're not talking Muslims.
Is Trump moving ahead faster than any president that you've ever witnessed?
Well, I guess so, but that's just because I wasn't alive in 1933. I mean, the first 100 days of the Roosevelt administration are kind of the model for a 100-day accelerated start. But this is very remarkable. And of course, by the way, it's not just Trump. Congress is getting into the act as well. Congress has discovered that we've got a president who will sign bills we send up to him. So one thing that's happening right now is a complete reversal of the imperial presidency as seen in Obama's last 4 or 5 years of office. Sure, we're hearing a lot about Trump right now, but there's going to be big stuff coming out of Congress as well, and Trump will sign it. So in short, the Constitution has returned to the kind of Constitution we always thought we had up to Obama.
What do you think is going to happen to Obamacare? What is the shape of the health insurance plan that's actually taking shape in Congress?
Well, we know a couple of things from Trump. I mean, there are things Trump will not accept. He will not accept, that is, he would veto. He would not accept a repeal of Obamacare, which leaves people in the lurch. In short, it's not just repeal, it's repeal plus replace. So you don't take anything away before you've got some alternate plans there. And the second thing is, he wants whatever is going to emerge, that replace part of it, he wants something that provides coverage for everybody. And frankly, you know, I do know one way to do it, and that's single payer, right? And that's not what anybody seems to want, although it can work fairly well.
But well, that's because you're Canadian.
Exactly. And by the way, I saw the inauguration at the Canadian embassy, so maybe I didn't get that level of enthusiasm. What I saw is a very polite crowd drinking their Canadian beer.
But I understand that one of the first meetings that Trump plans to have is with the Prime Minister of Canada.
Yeah, the President of Mexico and the Prime Minister of Canada. NAFTA will be on the cards. I mean, trade with NAFTA is something like 30% of U.S. foreign trade.
Would you explain to our listeners why that's such a crucial issue? I mean, I think a lot of people don't know what that means.
You know, Canadian trade is bigger than Mexican trade, but not by a heck of a lot. There are 30 states in the, more than 32 states in the United States whose major export partner is Canada. That is, they send more to Canada than to any other country. So American jobs are tied to goods produced here and exported to Canada. A lot of Canadian jobs also, there's a very integrated economy, you know, between those two countries. Plus, we're talking about two very advanced economies, tightly integrated. If the Ambassador Bridge in Detroit were closed for a week, millions of Americans would be very quickly put out of work. And that's because the auto industry is importantly a transnational, binational auto industry with goods produced in Canada and shipped to the States and vice versa. You know, the old model where a car gets made, I mean, you know, the steel enters at one end and the car emerges at the end, other end of the factory, that doesn't happen anymore. Instead, what you've got are thousands of little, you know, parts manufacturers, suppliers. You operate on a just-in-time basis. So if one part, I mean, if there's a road accident on the Ambassador Bridge, you know, Detroit will feel it within a couple of hours, right? I mean, it's going to put a spanner in the works immediately. So it's crucial to keep that going for American jobs as well as for Canadian jobs. And indeed, if NAFTA were abandoned, if Trump decided to get out of NAFTA, you know what? Canadian-U.S. trade wouldn't be affected because behind NAFTA is a prior free trade agreement between the two countries. So, you know, that's not going to change, basically. I mean, Canada is sort of the model of doing it right.
But it is going to change with Mexico, I think.
Yeah, Mexico is different. But there are going to be some small, you know, quarrels with Canada over one thing or another. There are things you can improve. Mexico is kind of a bigger deal. But Mexico as well, you know, is not the offender the way China is. So when you think about Trump's trade problems, think mostly about China, not Japan. I mean, I'm going to be interviewed on Japanese TV right after this, but not Japan, really China more than any place else. And why is that? Well, because other countries like Japan and Canada are democracies, and they have equivalent economies. And, you know, even as Canadian-U.S. trade is completely integrated, the Japanese have a lot of factories, car factories, in the United States. So, you know, Japan is very much a good boy as far as that. Because there are no Chinese plants operating in the United States. It's not like they're bringing jobs here. Totally one-sided. And it's a rogue regime in many ways. It's not a democracy, and it has military ambitions. I mean, it thinks of its military or its economy as an extension of the military, whereas I think Trump sees it just 180 degrees different. For Trump, trade dominates the military. For the Chinese, the military dominates.
And, of course, he said that he warned the Chinese that he wasn't going to allow them just to continue to claim territory in the South Pacific, right?
Yeah, and that goes to one way in which one wants to understand the American military and our strategic objectives. We want to protect the passageways in the ocean. We want to protect our trade generally. That's what our military does. That's what our Navy does. And if we start conceding trade routes, then where does that stop? I mean, well, you know, we have a problem with the Straits of Hormuz. We have a problem with the South China Seas. I mean, we don't want the world to close up.
Bad
for our industries.
So, in other words, the lack of tariffs, which NAFTA represents, that is the cost, the lack of taxes added to products brought in, say, from China, is more egregious from the China point of view because we're paying for goods but there's no American partner in the profit side of that.
Yeah, they manipulate their currency to get to make their goods cheap, and they steal our intellectual property. That's absolutely huge. I mean, if an American business wants to open up shop in China, you know, fantastic, huge markets, you can't just open up a U.S. business there. What you have to do is co-partner with a Chinese business, and the Chinese business will assert ownership of all the proprietary secrets and trade information, trade secrets, all the secret patentable information of the American partner. So it's gone. Right? And they'll do that to get that information, and then they'll knock off stuff on the cheap. And incidentally, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, my wife tells me this, when you start buying products from China, you start realizing pretty quickly that they're junk, right? I mean, we've taken to buying American products, I mean, for a lot of reasons, but one of them is, patriotism aside, they're just built a whole heck of a lot better. You know, if the idea is when you buy a stove, it should last you 20 years or a fridge, well, that's true if it's an American product, but it's not true if it's a Chinese product. So beware of false economies.
Well, I noticed that in the inaugural speech, Trump said we're going to buy American and we're going to hire American.
Yeah. Well, those are good policies. I mean, you know, you want to temper that with the idea that we the American economy depends importantly on trade. If you want to hire American, then, for example, you have to realize that a lot of American jobs are jobs producing goods that are sold outside the United States. You know.
Of course, I did think of you at that moment, being a Canadian. We'll be right back with Frank Buckley, more on what's going on with the Trump administration after this brief message.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Then Jesus taught those seeking him, then and now, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And, in an extreme case, which I'm afraid is not rare, blessed you when they revile you and persecute you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven." To finish up with, your baptism calls you to a prophetic life. You've been called to sanctify the world and human life. How are you going to do that? By living out these Beatitudes. We sometimes talk of children acting out their problems. We're called to act out the Beatitudes. They're Jesus' blueprint for the Christian life. Blessed is better translated for us today as how fortunate or how happy. God intends us to pant and sigh for him, as the psalm says. Panting and sighing for God with one's life breath is the occupation of the humble, who depend on God's mercy. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the reading read this Sunday at Mass. And remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
With Frank Buckley. He's a professor, as you know, at the Scalia School of Law at George Mason, and did some speech writing for Donald Trump during the campaign. He's a dual citizen of Canada and America, so we should make that clear. And I'm wondering, Frank, if you think that the other side, and of course Obama's staying in Washington and Hillary's thinking about running for mayor of New York or something, what have they got up their sleeve, other than this sort of general attempt to delegitimize the Trump administration?
Well, they've got a bunch of problems, obviously. I mean, they're long in the tooth. And they've got a base which is absolutely embarrassing. I mean, they used to say that our base was embarrassing, right? Tea Party types. I thought the Tea Party people were just wonderful. But their base is really, really unpleasant. I mean, you have a lot of the Black Lives Matter crowd, and you have a lot of, well, the kind of people who showed up with obscene signs on Saturday, the Women's March, for example. You know, or the people who disrupted the parties on last Thursday night. Yeah, a pretty nasty crowd. You know, thinking back to the riots on Thursday and Friday, our guys don't do that, but they do that and they get away with it and it's kind of accepted. It's they have the right to riot. Well, maybe now they don't. I hope that once confirmed, Jeff Sessions will ensure that those guys spend quite a few years in jail. So they've got their problems with the base. I think their basic strategy is just to be as butt as mean and nasty as they can, and the whole strategy is based on the legitimacy of the election. So you'll recall that Donald Trump said he wasn't sure if he'd accept, you know, the election results. And everybody went nuts. And, of course, ever since the election, nobody amongst the Democrats seems much prepared to accept the election results. Instead, what we're seeing are what I think are really silly stories about Russian influence. We're also seeing stories about how the Electoral College system is a problem. I mean, the first thing they tried to do was to say the Russians threw the election. The next thing they tried to do is to persuade electors to switch their votes. And now they're coming up with an impeachment strategy. And, of course, the strategy will get nowhere. I mean, it's based upon silly things like the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution that is really not triggered, and it's but nevertheless.
Tell our listeners what that is.
Well, here's the idea. I guess at one point early on, Benjamin Franklin received a snuff box from the King of France. And that was so embarrassing. I mean, it looked a little bit like a bribe, but, you know, in fact, it was just a small token. But, in fact, the framers were so concerned about bribery, they were so concerned about Republican virtue, that they wrote into the Constitution clauses to the effect that government officials and the president should not be able to accept bribes. And for bribes, they used the word emolument. And what that meant was a gift from a foreign government or from the U.S. government or a state government, right? And we're all against bribery. There's a bit of litigation that's being gingered up right now. And the theory is if Trump has a hotel and some government official in Britain or France spends a night in the hotel, that's an emolument, that's a gift to Donald Trump. You know, now, Trump...
Not if they pay for it.
Exactly. You know, there's a distinction between a gift and what happens when you and I go into Macy's to buy something, right? We buy a pair of gloves. That's not a gift. That's a bargain. It's a commercial or consumer bargain. So everybody understands the distinction between a gift and a purchase that you pay for, yeah, at fair market value. So if their theory was, I'll never get off the ground, but if their theory was right, then no businessman really could ever become president, which they probably would be happy with. I mean, they probably like to be just community organizers. But I mean, you know, to give you an example, I mean, you know, Obama wrote books and they were sold, and some of them were probably bought by foreign government officials. I mean, was that a problem? And Obama received the Nobel Prize, and that wasn't chump change. And, you know, so that's an emolument if anything is. So, operating the Trump Hotel and taking in paying guests that pay the same as you or I would, that's like buying gloves at Macy's.
And you and I can't afford them.
Yeah. I don't believe that. Come on. I see you. Stop buying those knickers, for heaven's sake.
That's what my sister says. I read today that regarding United Nations and other international organizations that the United States has been supporting, that the Trump administration is planning a 40% overall decrease in funding.
Okay.
Now, that's substantial.
It's substantial, and I'll tell you why it makes sense and why the figure is reasonable. At this point, we pay 22% of the budget of the United Nations, but our percentage of the world's GDP is only 16%. So I don't see any reason why we should be paying more than 16% of the budget of the United Nations. And 22 less 16%, well, that's about a 40% difference off that. So that strikes me as exactly the right figure.
The same would be true with NATO, I assume?
Well, NATO, the idea is we're spending about 3% of our GDP on the military, and Canada's spending only 1%. There are a lot of countries that are free riding on us. And what Trump has said about that is, look, let's you guys try to get up to the 2% level. And as it is right now, what we've got are countries like Estonia that are doing the 2%, but not most countries. And what's happened, therefore, is, you know, we have all these members in NATO. I mean, NATO was absurdly expanded over the last, under the Bush administration in particular, and Clinton. And those allies, well, they're fine and they're wonderful people, but it begins to look more like protectorates than allies. I mean, I think Albania wants to join NATO. What are we going to get from NATO?
Right.
What they're going to get from us is Article 5 of the NATO Treaty and our promise to defend them if attacked. Well, I tell you something, you know, they could spend 100% of their GDP on military, and it still wouldn't be equivalent to the value of our promises.
There ought to be some quid pro quo built into these things.
There should be some quid pro quo, and frankly, it is indeed time to start wondering what's it all about, Kelpie. I mean, Trump said we're going to remain loyal to our existing allies. And he meant NATO, so he's not going to shake things up too much. But it's time to start asking, gee, should NATO be doing something else, like interdicting refugees who are trying to get into Europe? I mean, that would be something for it to do. Trump also said we will make new alliances, or we will reach out to possible new allies. That's Russia. So, I mean, we're contemplating a complete reversal of U.S. policy. It should have been done 25 years ago with the collapse of the Soviet Union, but Bill Clinton had other things in his mind at the time, and Boris Yeltsin, too.
Yeah. The relationship to China, however, does seem to be the one fraught with the most difficulties. Am I correct?
I think you're right. I think everything else is manageable. I think Russia is manageable.
I think Mexico is manageable.
In particular, Russia is much more desirous of a relationship with us than with China. As for China, I'm thinking that it would help to send a message that we aren't patsies. Now, trade is going to dominate. I mean, we've already said we're not going to accept those islands, but trade is going to dominate, and we will see how other countries line up. Interestingly, before the election, Australia had already conceded to China those islands, and China has plans for what might be called a Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Zone, if you recall the Japanese report to it. They are building these super fast railways down to Singapore and Burma, and the idea is, you know, we are the dominant. This is our neck of the woods, and don't pay attention to America. Pay attention to us.
Well, when I see, as I did 2 days ago, that China has ordered the closure of 111 golf courses out of some 700. Because of its association with the West and so forth. Something's going on there.
Yeah, they are becoming militarily more aggressive. As I say, they see their economy as the handmaiden of the military, and that's how we're so very different from them, right? I mean, back in the time of Deng Xiaoping, the idea was we're going to make everybody rich, and that's our solution to the problem of democracy. They're not going to bother us about democracy if we make them all rich. Well, you know, they've been made rich. Democracy isn't a question, but so I don't think they feel that, you know, making people rich is all about protecting their position on top of the heap. Now they feel so secure about their position that they can start thinking about imperialist plans to extend the sphere of influence of China across the East. And that's dangerous. I mean, it impacts Japan, certainly, the Philippines.
Korea, obviously.
Yeah, South Korea, and Australia and New Zealand. So,
but we do have this little wrinkle that I find very hopeful, and that is Trump's relationship with the entrepreneur of an owner of Alibaba. And Alibaba, of course, is the largest e-commerce site in China. And it's more or less the equivalent of Amazon. And evidently there has been conversation. His name is Jack Ma, by the way, M-A.
Right.
Some conversation about bringing Alibaba to the United States so that Amazon would have some sort of competition.
Yeah. Well, you know, from a business perspective, that makes perfect sense. Of course, you know, Amazon itself is a deeply liberal, progressive, democratic firm in terms of its management and where it gets its money. But it, you know, that's strictly business. I think the trick will be trying to persuade the Chinese government that its imperialist project is not going to get off the ground. Right, and as well, its manner of conducting business by way of ripping off our intellectual secrets, that's not going to work as well. So that, you know, but it's primarily going to be a trade agenda rather more than a military agenda. We're going to go after them and other countries as well, and trade will be uppermost. I mean, if one were an ambassador anywhere, a U.S. ambassador appointed under Trump will be an ambassador who will have to really get down and dirty about the details of trade between our two countries.
Now, I want to ask you, Frank Buckley, a hypothetical question. I know that you have no plans whatsoever, and you sincerely have no plans to serve in this administration. You're not looking for a job, et cetera, et cetera. But if you could be ambassador to one country on behalf of the United States, which one would it be?
Oh, golly. Probably Canada. I mean, just because even though Ottawa is the most frigid country in the world, and I say that as, you know, on the basis that I would never be able to qualify for places like Rome or Paris.
But where are the fulcrum points going to be in the coming 4 years in terms of other nations' governmental relations to the United States? Where are the real leverage points?
Well, we mentioned China. The other one is Israel, and specifically and Iran. I think the Syria problem will take care of itself. I think ISIS will take care of itself, or rather, we will take care of ISIS more properly. I think as well with Iran, I wouldn't anticipate crazy adventurism by Iran.
Do we have an ambassador to Iran?
No.
No, I think so.
No. No, the concern with Iran has been the way it has funded Hamas and terrorists generally.
Right.
And that, we're going to have to do something about that. I'm not sure what. I mean, that's something that people at the NSC are thinking about, doubtless. But, you know, the money trail. And we'll also have to come to an understanding with respect to the Palestinian Authority, which is a deeply, deeply corrupt organization.
I noticed that Obama, on the morning of the inauguration, I mean, literally hours before Trump became president, sent another, or trying to send another $200 million plus to the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, what a lot of people don't realize is that the Palestinian Authority close on 20% of its budget is given to people in jail for terrorism or their families. And this, they don't distinguish really between terrorists from the West Bank and terrorists from Gaza. I mean, they say they do, but they don't. And as such, of that $270 million, whatever it was, billion.
Well, that's 27, no, that's 40, 54 million going to it.
Yeah, whatever it was, yeah, you know, 20% of it was given to support terrorists, including terrorists who have killed Americans. Right? And why do you give money for that? Why do you give money to the families of people who have killed Americans? How could you possibly explain?
We probably consider them freedom fighters of some sort.
Yeah, well, I mean, the only way you can do that is if you don't care about Americans, which is, I think, what the way a lot of people think about the Obama administration. I mean, we had this election, and part of it was, we don't think you care about us much.
Do you think the embassy will move to Jerusalem out of Tel Aviv?
It's hard to say. There's been a lot of noise back and forth about this. Trump initially, there was a story last week that Trump definitely wants to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Another suggestion was, let's move the ambassador. I mean, there's a huge building, the American embassy in Tel Aviv. So you could leave that there and move the ambassador's residence to Jerusalem. Because as it is right now, the ambassador frequently has to travel a couple of hours from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And you know what? I mean, sometimes those meetings, they go on late. And when they go on late, you know what he does? He just checks into the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. So, you know, it's not a big deal. So
I'd go to the American colony myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm opposed to moving it to Jerusalem. I think it's too explosive. I think the idea of moving ambassadorial residence is a great alternative and should satisfy everyone concerned. But again, you're going to have, evidently you have some very, very powerful Jewish donors, Republican Party, who are making that their bottom line.
Well, I'm not so sure. I think Jared Kushner would be happy if it were just the ambassador himself. That's, you know, the story coming out of Israel is we were talking about the ambassador's residence, not the embassy.
Well, I hope that turns out to be the case.
Yeah, although one doesn't know. I mean, the point about moving the embassy is the idea, as you know, that that kind of move should await a final resolution of the problem. Although I don't know if we'll ever have a final resolution. And by the way, as you know, if they move the whole embassy to Jerusalem, it would be to that part of West Jerusalem, which nobody would possibly think would ever end up anywhere but in the state of Israel.
Right. It's not going to be in East Jerusalem, which is largely Arab of various types. Now, what is the significance, and while we're on the subject of the Middle East, of this relationship between Donald Trump and the president of Egypt? This seems to be a pretty good relationship.
Yeah, there is a very good relationship. The thing to understand about President Sisi of Egypt was how much he was hated by the Obama White House. And the Obama White House had a very tender spot for the Muslim Brotherhood. And it celebrated the revolution which took down Mubarak. It was delighted when it had no problems with the Muslim Brotherhood winning the subsequent election. The head of the NSC, I guess, Clapper, testified before Congress that he did not think the Muslim Brotherhood was a terrorist organization. Well, guess what? It really is a terrorist organization. It is the same thing as Hamas. It's the same thing as Al-Qaeda. There is no difference between them. These are just different names in different countries. So the Muslim Brotherhood, which went around killing Christians and the like, finally, it became clear finally that it was determined to put an end to democracy in Egypt, which is what led to the army coup led by General Sisi, who now, I think, enjoys a great deal of popularity in Egypt. But of course, because he shut down the Muslim Brotherhood, he is tremendously unpopular with the liberal press in the United States, with the Washington Post, for example, with the Obama administration. He does, however, have a relationship with the Israelis, with Netanyahu.
Well, that's good. That's good. And I noticed in 2006 he took a course at the United States Army War College here in the United States.
Yeah.
So in other words, he's got relationships with the United States, with Great Britain, with Israel that suggest stability for a change.
He is opposed to terrorism. Trump likes him. Obama didn't. Real simple. I mean, I really can't put it much more simply than that. So if there were an effort to bring peace to the Middle East, he would be a great interlocutor.
It seems like everyone who tries to bring real peace to the Middle East ends up being shot.
Which
is the problem, right?
Yes, certainly in Egypt.
And in Israel.
Yeah. So,
well, he's President Zizi is still a young man, and he if Trump can succeed in maintaining strong relationships with Netanyahu, which he has with Sisi, and then Sisi and Netanyahu have a strong relationship, that certainly bodes well for the future of that region, at least as under this administration.
Yes, and Jordan as well. The Jordans are very nervous, much more nervous than Sisi is. The Jordanians are rather more nervous than the Egyptians about
Trump.
Actually, they will get along. They get along with Trump, but the point is they cannot be pro-Israeli in the sense that Sisi is.
No, they can't outwardly be.
They can't outwardly. Yeah.
Because I think the relationship between the Jordanian government and the king and queen there and the United States leadership has been very good, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's the only country that has not, in the Middle East, that has not been, thus far, knock on wood, the site of terrorist attacks.
Yeah. And it signed a peace deal with Israel in 1993. It was negotiated on the Israeli side by a friend of mine who's the then Attorney General and who's now in the Israeli Supreme Court, Eli Rubinstein. There's a lot of mutual respect between the Israelis and the Jordanians.
Which is excellent because they're neighbors. Of course, they're neighbors slightly separated by the reality of the West Bank.
Yeah.
And the... Do you think that a two-state solution is completely now a thing of the past?
It was made harder, certainly, by the Security Council resolution of December 24. The Security Council resolution basically said anything that happened after 1947, is completely, illegitimate. Israel only has a right to that land it won after its war of independence. And
well, that,
the Israelis,
yes.
The Israelis call that the Holocaust border.
Well, that was a very... I think even those of us, including myself, who have goodwill toward the Palestinians and their effort, I think that was way overboard. That was a mistake on the Palestinian side.
I hope they also can flourish. I just don't think they can do it with the present.
No, and they've got all the wrong friends. I might put it that way.
The problem with the Security Council resolution is if the basis for peace is land for peace, the Israelis have no land to give away under the Security Council resolution. So that simply destroys the basis for land for peace.
Frank Buckley, thanks for being on Church and Culture today to bring us up to date on how this new administration is going, and best of luck with all your efforts to explain the United States to places like Japan and other places around the world that are probably rather anxious at the moment.
Oh, well, great. Thank you so much. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Frank. And for all of you listening to Church and Culture, I'll be back on this day, this time, next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, in Eastern churches, liturgy and asceticism have their own respective evangelical power, which must be continually rediscovered and unleashed as the way for the Eastern churches to evangelize and make a difference.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
If you put your parenting in question, not so long ago I was standing outside a preschool class, just watching, that's what we shrinks do, observe, and I noticed most of the parents asking their children to behave, asking their children to cooperate. It went something like this. Jason, don't you think it's time we go now? Molly, why don't you put your coat on? Sarah, could you come along with me, please? Now, there's nothing wrong with asking a child to cooperate. I think the problem was this was the main style. The implication is, gee, I sure hope you'll go along with me. Gee, I sure hope you'll cooperate. Nothing wrong with a question as long as the child understands it's not really a question. For example, if you say, Butkus, why don't you put your coat on now? And Butkus knows you mean, Butkus, please put your coat on now. I don't think your questions will get you in trouble. But if questions become your prime mode of eliciting cooperation from little Butkus, he's going to logically think, why don't I put my coat on now? Because I don't want to. I'm Dr. Ray.
How are the people of God, the church, related to religions who have yet to receive the gospel? According to the Catholic Catechism, the church is linked to the Jewish religion. The Jews were the first to hear the word of God. The Jewish faith is already a response to God's revelation in the Old Covenant. To the Jews belong the patriarchs, the sonship, the giving of the law, the worship and the promises. Of their race, according to the flesh, is the Christ. For the gifts, says the Catechism, and the call of God are irrevocable. The Muslims are related to the church in that they acknowledge the Creator, profess to hold the faith of Abraham, and adore the one merciful God, mankind's judge on the last day. The church's bond with other non-Christian religions stems from the common belief in the origin and end of the human race, which in both cases is our Creator God. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta. Join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's talk radio where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus encounters a rich young man who seems very serious about following him. But when the wealthy young man is confronted with the need for total detachment from his possessions, he is